I don't sell anymore. I've been out of sales for just over a year. I'm going to share with you and your listeners the number one line that I used every single time I walked into a listing presentation, which set the tone for the entire presentation, which your listeners are welcome to use. And I would say to the vendors when I arrived, look, I'm here for one reason and one reason only. And then I'd bite my tongue and they'd look at me like, what's that?
You're listening to Elevate, the official podcast of Elite Agent for Real Estate Industry, sales professionals, property managers, and leaders. We bring you the best minds in business and real estate to help you list more, sell more, and elevate your results. To download your written action guide from this podcast containing extra tips, links, and shortcuts, visit EliteAgentElevate.com. Now, here is your host, Samantha McLean.
Welcome to another episode of the Elevate Podcast, where we delve into some of the most interesting minds in business and in real estate for the very best tips and strategies for you to implement to elevate your business. I'm Samantha McLean, editor of Elite Agent and host of this week's show. Today, my guest is Chief Executive Officer of Brisbane-based agency Urban X. Welcome to the show, Dan Argent.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to see you.
Yeah, finally we catch up.
Absolutely. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. I follow your podcast. I listen to it religiously. So it's nice to be on the other side of it.
Yeah, well, we'd like to be in Brisbane right about now, actually sort of looking at you, but Anastasia still won't open the borders. So here we are.
No, I don't really understand that, but it is the place to be. It's the middle of winter and I'm wearing a t-shirt and, you know, it's not even jumper weather. So it's a great place to live.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's the market like in Brisbane at the moment, given what's happened for the last few months?
Yeah, look, much like it is everywhere really at the moment, it's certainly been impacted by what's been happening over the last couple of months. We're starting to obviously see less buyers in the market. Banks are being more choosy with who they give finance to. Buyers are concerned about job security and not wanting to necessarily take on huge commitments. And also, you know, I find with any transition market, there ends up being a discrepancy between what buyers think a property is worth and what sellers think a property is worth. And I call them transitioning markets where those two are out of alignment. And when those are out of alignment with their expectations on value, it can really have an impact on volume of sales. So look, there's definitely still transactions happening. I'm seeing most properties that are selling within the first 3 weeks, and properties that are sitting on the market for longer than that are going stale pretty quickly and take a lot of extra effort and strategy to get sold. So, you know, it's certainly challenging, but I wouldn't be surprised, Samantha, if there's a more challenging period ahead. This period that we're in right now reminds me a lot of the last downturn, which was the GFC. And the GFC was underway for a while before it really started to have a huge impact on the property market. It wouldn't surprise me if COVID-19's much the same, that the hit will be a bit delayed.
Yeah. So you feel like we're in a bit of a transitionary period right now?
That's what I feel like. And look, there's obviously a lot of talk about what's going to happen later this year as some of the stimulus starts to come out of the economy. It wouldn't surprise me at all if we start to see more of an impact on property prices, which ultimately results in less transactions. And so, you know, it's just starting to get ready for those. And this is not being negative in any way whatsoever. I actually see an incredible opportunity that comes out of downturns. You know, when you look at some of the top 100, 200 agents in Australia, many of them have been in the industry for an average of 15 years. Well, it's no surprise that they've been through a couple of downturns already. And I actually see each downturn as an accelerator. And so the agents that get through those can come out the other side doing so much better. And it's like they actually sort of, you know, use it as a springboard to go to the next level in their business and career.
Interesting. So let's rewind back to 2007, 2008, back to those scary GFC days. And I'm told only us Aussies call it the GFC. Everyone calls it something else. must have felt very global to us. So you were selling real estate back then. Tell me about what that was like when the financial crisis actually hit.
Well, it was enormous. I mean, I went from selling four houses a month to one house a month. The financial hit was enormous. I remember the very first open house. I remember the address. I remember the time. I remember everything about the very first open house I did where nobody turned up. You know, I'd been in real estate for 7 years at this point in time, and I'd never had an open house before where nobody turned up. And I remember jumping straight online on my phone going, oh, the times are wrong. No, the times were there and they were correct and nobody had turned up. And I just remember thinking, oh my gosh, what's this? You know, that became pretty common practice over those GFC years where people just didn't turn up. So Yeah, it got real hard real fast. And I had to implement certain strategies into my business to not only survive, but now in hindsight, those things also set me up to thrive on the other side. And leading into the GFC, I was writing about $700,000 a year. During those GFC years, that dropped to about $250,000. And then straight after, I went up to $1.2 million, and I maintained that, you know, for the next 5 or 6 years coming out of the GFC. So yeah, there were things I had to do to survive, but they were also the things that set me up and, you know, to survive and thrive on the other side.
Do you mind talking about some of those? Because there are really mixed feelings out there at the moment from what I'm hearing from various agents. Like, some people out there have used the COVID experience, let's call it, as an opportunity to lean down a bit and remove some expenses from the business and get more efficient. And there are other agents that have remained positive out there that are still picking up good business. And then I've heard the horror stories of people being really negative and just, you know, missing a trick completely. So can you tell me a bit about how you managed to pull yourself through, because 700,000, they're good numbers, and then dropping to 250, like, how did you pull yourself back out to break the mill after that?
Yeah, okay. I had to find what I could focus on every day. So my number one strategy was a strategy that I call 21-20. And what that means is I would connect every single day with 20 people that owned a property in my area with the goal of booking one face-to-face meeting per day. So, you know, that might have taken me 40 or 50 phone calls to get 20 connects. And out of 20 connects, I had to get a minimum of one face-to-face meeting booked in every single day. And so as long as I did that 5 days a week, 4 weeks a month, that would get me 20 face-to-face meetings per month with people that owned a property in my area. And I knew that out of that, I could get 2 or 3 listings. So that gave me something really positive and really proactive that I could focus on every day. And I like to break my day up into AM, PM. And so I made this the first thing that I did every single day. And so by lunchtime every day, I had to have connected with 20 people and booked one meeting. Now, it seems like a really simple strategy, but it is the most powerful strategy I've ever implemented in my career. If you think about it, it's not rocket science. Like, it just makes sense that if you're connecting with 20 people that own a property in your area and getting one meeting a day with someone that owns a property in your area, you are bound to get listings from that. And people always say, well, what did you say to these people?
And I was about to ask you that.
I knew you would. And I just would share positive stories. In a negative environment where people are being bombarded with negative news, positive stories shone out really strongly. And so I would share a result of a property that I might have sold with multiple offers in the first week, or a price record that I might have set, or a great result that I might have achieved, or maybe it was a result that someone else achieved, but I just found something positive to share with people, and people really resonated with that. And they were looking for hope. And, you know, maybe that's what Obama did when he became the president, was, you know, he gave people hope. And that's what people are looking for. And so positive stories gave people hope, and that would, you know, generally find someone that would say, oh, great, well, why don't you come around and talk to me about my property? And then as long as you do that 20 times a month minimum, you'll find 2 or 3 at least that want to sell.
So it's just purely a numbers game.
It's just a numbers game, you know, 21-20. 20 connections a day, one appointment a day. One appointment a day is 20 a month. And out of 20 a month, I could get 2 or 3 listings. It was a numbers game, and it was something that I could just focus really proactively on. And so that was my morning. And then my afternoon was meetings, appraisals, buyer inspections, listing presentations, negotiations. I wouldn't do anything in the morning. I just blocked out my morning to be on the phone, and then I did all my appointments in the afternoon. So that was my number one strategy. And this is the opportunity, right? Because to have a real attraction business, you've got to have a 20% market share. You know, I've been in this industry for 16 years, and if I don't have 20% market share, I just find that my phone doesn't ring as much from sellers. I'm not getting as many call-ins. When I do have a 20% market share, you start to get more and more calls from people saying, look, I'm thinking about selling. Can you come around and have a chat to me? So, you know, here's the opportunity, right? If you continue to focus on something proactive like this, let's just say that there's normally 50 properties for sale in your area and you have 5 of those. Well, you have a 10% market share. But if, say, according to realestate.com, there's been a 30% reduction in listings. So instead of there being 50 properties in your area for sale, there's only 35, but you still manage to have your standard, which is that you always carry 5 listings in your immediate marketplace. Well, your market share has increased to around 15%. But if you focus on something really proactive, like that 21-20 strategy, and you increase your market share just to 7 listings instead of 5, you now have 7 out of 35, you have a 20% market share. And Samantha, a 20% market share is the magic number where you will create an attraction business.
Is that something that you've come up with over the years?
I can't give you any scientific equation, but that's just my experience, is that when I have 1 in 5 properties for sale in my area, when people go online and 1 out of every 5 listings is mine, I just find I get substantially more call-ins than any less than that.
Should go in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy along with 42. Actually, 21-20. No, it doesn't quite add to 42.
Oh, so close. 41.
So close, though. I'm a numbers person too. You know, in 21-20, it just occurred to me, like, you know, we just did a round of Transform where we had a US coach basically give us the strategy of trying to help business owners during this time, because in the US, he feels that business owners will be most affected, particularly the ones that have, you know, struggled through COVID-19 or have had to close their doors and might be, you know, thinking about selling the family home. What's your opinion on that? Are there particular people that you would target with 21-20 while you're making 20 phone calls a day?
It's a great question, but no, I just really targeted the people that had properties in my area. And, you know, I always advise agents to have a niche. And so I worked in a suburb in Brisbane, which is Paddington, which is where Suncorp Stadium is, which is where Queensland beat New South Wales most years in the state of origin. I'm sure you've heard of it.
I can't talk now.
and that's just down the road. Well, I decided the niche that I wanted to carve out was that suburb, so Paddington. Houses, so not apartments, not townhouses, but just houses, and houses over $1 million. Now, there are some properties that are under $1 million, like smaller cottages and whatnot. So my niche was very specific. Houses in Paddington over $1 million. And so that's as targeted as I was, Samantha. I just ensured that the people that I were connecting with were the people that had houses in Paddington worth $1 million or more. And so any appointments that I got were with people that I wanted to do business with. And also, I obviously had a lot of knowledge about that market because that was predominantly what I transacted on. So I'm calling people with stories and results about properties that relate to properties that were like theirs.
Yeah, that sounds very much like, you know, someone like Josh Teslin's strategy. He's the duplex guy.
You
know, so if you got a duplex, you know you got to call Josh.
You know, when I saw the quote that was in your newsletter from Josh earlier this week or maybe last week, and he said, you've got to saturate your market. And I couldn't agree more. You know, I shared that through my social media. You've got to saturate your market, and he's spot on. And that's, in a way, one of the strategies that we're talking about now.
Yeah. Okay. So was that...
That's number one. Number two, really clear goals. When I first started in real estate, I was given the advice, you can have anything you want in life if you set clear goals and work hard. And so setting really clear goals for me during that period is what drove me. There were some tough days and some tough weeks, and I'm sure many of your listeners are going to be experiencing the same. And so I needed to know what was driving me. And so I broke down my goals into medium-sized goals, large goals, and small goals, and even micro goals. And so, like, an example of a micro goal was that, I mean, I love coffee. I love good coffee, certainly not, you know, Nescafe. I want to go and have a nice espresso, but I wouldn't allow myself a coffee until I'd made my 20 connections. And so that was my, like, micro goal. Make your 20 connections, get your 1 face-to-face appointment, and then go and get a coffee. That would drive me each day. And then I might set like a small goal, which might be a weekly goal. So get a listing a week. And then I'm going to go and reward myself maybe with dinner out on Saturday night. But if I don't get my 1 listing for the week, then I'm not going to go out for dinner on Saturday night. And then I would have medium-sized goals, and they might be to get 2 or 3 sales for the month, or, you know, whatever result I wanted, I would attach it to a goal. So then it might be, well, if I achieve that, I'm going to go away for the weekend, or I might buy a small gift, or every single result that I wanted to drive got attached to a goal. And I remember 2011, which for many in real estate was the toughest year in real estate, 2011, 2012, but certainly 2011. It was when the GFC really started to impact us here in Australia. And, you know, this is just a funny goal and it was personal and it's materialistic and everyone will have their own goals, but I wanted to buy a Rolex. You know, I like watches and I wanted to buy a Rolex. And so I thought, you know what, if I can sell, you know, a certain amount, I'm going to reward myself with a Rolex. So that was my large goal. And can I tell you, on those days where you'd had 19 people hang up on you, you know, you hadn't booked your one meeting, you hadn't sold anything, you were feeling crap, you know, I just think about, no, I've got to make more calls. I've got to do this. I've got to do that because I've got to get that Rolex. And I just chipped away at it. And, you know, it was probably November of that year that I finally hit the goal that I had to get. And I remember going in and buying my watch and I was so excited. Ultimately, it was just something that drove me, you know. And so I just say strategy number two is have really clear goals. If you don't have clear goals and if you don't know why you're working hard and what you want to achieve and you can't clearly measure it, then how are you ever going to achieve it? Most people that I talk to that are feeling lost, Samantha, the first thing I ask them is, what's your goals? What do you want to achieve? And they don't know. And so when you've got super clear goals and you know exactly what you want, it'll drive you through those really hard times.
I like that too, because your little goals actually give you something to look forward to. You know, as a little bit of a reward, you can sort of say to yourself, come on, how much do you really want this?
Yep.
And then I suppose it makes you think back to why it is you're doing what you're doing.
You're exactly right. And so for some people, it's to take their family overseas. For some people, it's to buy a new car. For some people, it's to pay the school fees. Everyone's got their own reasons. So, you know, goals are unique and they should be, but you've got to be clear on them. You've got to write down everything that you want to achieve, break it down into large, medium, small, and micro, and then attach it to the activities that you need to do, such as 2120 and others, that are going to drive your business. When you know exactly what you want and why you're doing it, that's how you get through those really difficult times. You're spot on.
Even now, the big hairy goal might just be getting through this period, you know, you might just be saying to yourself something like resilience, let's get out of here stronger.
You might set a goal to achieve between now and the end of the year. You know, it's around the middle of the year and you might be like, oh my gosh, I've got to get through this. Right. Well, between now and the end of the year, I want to sell $10 million worth of real estate or whatever the number might be. And you just go, right. Well, if I can achieve that, I'm going to reward myself with whatever it might be. Something that really is something that you really want. And that's going to drive you every day. Number three is I focused with all of the listings that I got. So obviously these strategies are all to get listings. Once I got listings, what we see is a lot of agents have got a prospecting strategy, but then they don't have a selling strategy. And they get a property and then nothing really happens with it. You know, we start to see average days on market blow out. We start to see properties that get listed and there's no clear plan to sell it. So you got to have a clear plan to sell it. And the two things that I focused on were price and presentation. What I found was that no matter whether the market was absolutely booming or the market was absolutely in the doldrums, the only two reasons why any property wouldn't sell was price or presentation. Most agents just focus on price, but the first one that I focused on was presentation. And I tried to make every single listing that I got look like it was ready to go in, you know, Vogue Living magazine or some, you know, kind of publication. I knew that people lived in these properties. They might have had kids, all of these kind of things. But I had to make sure that property looked sensational. And so I would take the owner all the way out to the footpath with a notepad and pen. And we would write notes about how the buyers were going to see that property from the moment they arrived. What's the footpath like? What's the front fence like? What's the pathway like? What's the garden like? What's the driveway like? What's the outside of the house look like? What do the windows look like? What does the front door look like? I mean, you know, what does the front deck look like? We literally would go from the front street all the way through to the back fence. And we might make 30 notes on jobs that need to get done. And I can promise you that every single vendor that I worked with appreciated that so much because they lived in that property and they just overlooked these things and they'd be like, oh my gosh, like I hadn't even noticed that stuff. But because you're casting fresh eyes over the property, it's super clear to us. So I would work with these owners on getting the presentation of their property absolutely spick and span. And, you know, most owners would spend about $5,000 on tidying up the presentation of their property, paint, gurneying, external washing, this, that, and the other. And what I would explain to them was that whatever they spend on improving the presentation of their property would generally have a 5-to-1 return. So if they spent $5,000, that's more than likely going to get them at least $25,000 more back in the sale price. And I had so many case studies that demonstrated that. But the other thing too, Samantha, is once I had nailed the presentation on the property and made it look absolutely outstanding, not just physically, but also through the marketing, the photos, the write-up, etc., I knew that if it still wasn't selling, there was only one reason, and that was price. And so did the owners. And so that allowed us to have really honest and transparent conversations that there literally could be no other reason why that property wasn't selling, because it looked sensational. The marketing looked sensational. We all agreed on that point. If it still wasn't selling, it was price. I found it really important to have a conversation around price every single week. So many people leave it 3 or 4 weeks before they even have a conversation on price, if they ever have a conversation about price. But I would have a conversation about price every week, because what I found was that the first week was the best time to get the highest possible price. The second best time to get the highest possible price was the second week. The third best time to get the highest possible price was the third week, and so on and so forth. And so my vendors were geared up to understand that a quick sale is not about just getting it sold quickly. It's about that's when it's the newest. That's when there's the most amount of buyers looking at it. That's when there's the most amount of frustrated, money burning a hole in their pocket kind of buyers looking at it. And that's when they're getting to get the highest possible price. So look, that's strategy number three, Samantha. I would focus on price and presentation. And it might seem simple, but I found that many vendors would say, oh my goodness, like no one has spoken to us about this. Or they'd thank me for the recommendation around price and say, oh, this is, you know, we thought it was worth a certain price, but thank you for the feedback and showing us that it's not. And they would thank you for getting them a great price.
It's like John McGrath says, the highest price never came on day 90.
You're exactly right. You know, the highest price comes on day one. You're exactly right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was strategy number three.
Can I just ask you a question about that? So at the moment, while consumers are trying not to spend money and they're a bit worried about all sorts of other things like spending money on doing the house up, I mean, look, ScoMo's giving some people money to renovate right now, but it's pretty hard to come by, I gather, with all the conditions on it. You know, if you were to land yourself as an agent now into 2020 and you're explaining to someone that they need to spend money to do up their property, how would you have that conversation?
It's all about value. So, Samantha, everyone's got money. Whether you can get it or not is whether or not you can demonstrate value. And so ultimately, people aren't worried about parting with the money. They're worried about parting with the value. They value that $5,000 more in their bank account than they do giving it to you or spending it on their house. But if you can demonstrate value to them, then they will happily part with that money. So, you know, if I put that question back on you, if I said to you, Samantha, I have a way that I've helped 100 other people, they've given me $5,000 and I've given them back 25 and I've done it within a month, would you give me that money? And I can give you 100 other examples of people that I've done that for, you'd find the money, right? The reality is I could just demonstrate case study after case study after case study of properties that were well presented, well marketed, sold in the first week and got an outstanding price. And ultimately, that was my focus, was getting an outstanding price. And so I'm going to share with you, because I don't sell anymore, I've been out of sales for just over a year, I'm going to share with you and your listeners the number one line that I used every single time I walked into a listing presentation, which set the tone for the entire presentation, which your listeners are welcome to use. And I would say to the vendors when I arrived, look, I'm here for one reason and one reason only. And then I'd bite my tongue and they'd look at me like, what's that? And I'd say, I'm here to get you the best possible price. I'm not just here to sell your property. I'm here to set a street price record. And they'd go, yeah, awesome. We like the sound of that. And I'd say, so every recommendation I'm going to give you from this point forward is to get not just the property sold, but to set a street price record. Are you guys on board with that? And like 100% would say yes, because that's what everyone's interested in. And then the rest of that meeting, Samantha, was always referring back to the first thing that I said to them. This is how you're going to get a price record. This is how you're going to get a price record. This is how you're going to get a price record. So when I'm talking to them about painting the front fence and, you know, re-landscaping and hiring furniture and getting professional photography, and when I'm talking to them about these things, when I'm talking to them about decluttering, I'm not having a dig at the way you've got your property presented. Don't forget, I'm giving you advice so you can get a price record, because that's what I'm focused on. And I had so many price records that I'd achieved that I was able to use as case studies, and they all had the same formula. They were presented beautifully, had a clear pricing strategy or auction. I had a formula that worked, and so I was able to demonstrate that. And so, you know, don't think that I didn't come up against that objection that many of your listeners will be coming up against. Oh, I don't want to spend the money. I don't want to spend the money on marketing. You just have to demonstrate value. And when you can demonstrate value that investing in your property is going to get you substantially more back, reducing time on market will get you more money, having it beautifully presented obviously will attract more buyers to the property. More buyers to the property equals more competition. One extra buyer attracted to the property can end up in a multiple offer situation that you otherwise might not have been in. A multiple offer situation means that buyers are competing with each other, not with you. And when they're competing with each other, not with you, that's when you're going to set a record for your sale price.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, if the predictions are correct, you know, in 6 months' time, it'll be a case of 1%ers as well, like 1% better on the marketing and 1% better on the presentation and 1% better on they're all going to add up to a massive difference, I think, when there's competition in the market.
You're 100% right.
Well, thank God for that. What's next?
Okay. The fourth thing that I did during that time was that I saw my income absolutely plummeting. And, you know, I wasn't alone. Everyone was going through this. Many dropped out of the industry. It was a really unfortunate time. You know, we may see the same again, and I don't hope that on anyone, but hopefully people listening to this, some of these strategies might help them to actually survive and also thrive on the other side. But it was a really tough time. And Samantha, I was working for an agency during that time leading into it. And financially for me, I was unable to stay there because I was losing, you know, a considerable amount of my commission that I was generating to the agency. That's just the normal way that it is. But I looked at how much I was losing and I thought, geez, I really need to keep all of that, you know, for myself. I'm working so hard and I'm not getting much left over. And so the fourth thing that I did was that I decided to work for myself. And I was absolutely petrified. I thought so much of my success could have to do with working at an agency, and it was a great business and I worked with great people. But ultimately, it just came down to the financial aspect of it, was that I really needed to keep all of that commission for myself just to get through, really, honestly. And so the fourth thing that I did was that I started my own business, and I actually just worked from home. This was in 2011. In 2010, I'd just come off winning the REIQ Queensland Sales Agent of the Year. You know, business was good. When most buyers contacted me, they wanted to look at a property. I just met them at the property and you'd get the offer then and there, or maybe meet them at their house or do a second inspection. When sellers wanted to sell, you'd meet them at their property. No one ever came to my office anyway. So where I worked from didn't matter. And I remember when I first, you know, started working for myself, Samantha, I, you know, spoke to some of my good clients and my 90-day pipeline and asked if they'd still be happy to deal with me. And 100% of them said yes. And so that for me meant that I was able to keep all of the commission that I was generating, and I literally couldn't have survived financially during that downturn if I hadn't have worked for myself. As it stood, and I don't mind, you know, sharing this, I had $100,000 in savings in the bank at the start of 2011, which, you know, just sort of accrued over the years. By the end of the GFC, even working for myself and keeping all of my commission, I only had 5,000 left just because of what my expenses were. And that was keeping all of my commission. If I didn't, unfortunately, I would have been like many others and dropped out of the industry. So that was the fourth thing that I did to set myself up to survive during that downturn.
I think that's interesting, because back in 2012 was probably, if I could remember back there, there might have been some murmurs about the future of the shopfront. Because, you know, people are all wondering, you know, like, will people still want to walk into a real estate office? And it's funny, the debate has risen again now in 2020 because, well, we couldn't go into the office. Some of us couldn't. And so I guess cutting rent and expenses and things like that and doing business digitally, how have your agents connected with clients through this period?
Ultimately, if we look at some of those earlier strategies that we spoke about, 2120, I mean, that all comes from just being on the phone. You know, where you're on the phone from is completely irrelevant. No one asks you where you are.
Where are you? Yeah.
You know, where are you calling me from? No, I mean, physically, what location? The reality is that I've worked in a shopfront office for 7 years, and I then started to work from home, and nothing changed for me. None of my clients ever came into the office beforehand. I actually think it's personally, and this is only my personal view, I think it's poor service to have your clients come into the office. I believe that, you know, they're paying us a lot of money. My average sale price was $1 million. My average fee was $25,000. And that was never lost on me. I would never make my clients come into the office for anything. I would always go to them. the number one compliment that I used to love hearing and used to get a lot was people would say, oh, you just made that so easy. Well, how do you make it easy? You go to them. You know, you do everything you can. If they need you to go over at 7:30 at night after they've fed the kids, you go over at 7:30 at night. If they need you there at 7 o'clock in the morning, you go at 7 o'clock in the morning. If they need you to drop into their office at lunchtime in the city, you go to their office in the city at lunchtime. Like, you're being paid a lot of money to do what you're doing. And I would always offer the best service that I could. And for me, that always meant going to them. That was at 9:30 at night. That was at 9:30 at night. And so no one would ever come into my office anyway, Samantha. Buyers would never come into my office. Anyone who's looking for a property is looking online. They find a property they like. They inquire through email, SMS, or give you a call. They arrange an inspection. You meet them at the property. Any smart agent's going to have a contract with them. If they like it, you try and get an offer there. If they want to think about it or have a second inspection, I mean, ultimately, you're going to meet them at their house, a cafe, or at the actual property, get an offer, go to the vendor, present it. It's all mobile. So it had no impact on me whatsoever. You asked, how are our agents working with it now? None of the agents that we work with now have a shopfront. They're all doing incredibly well. They all find that they just don't need it.
Interesting. Oh, you know, we started a lead agent in the laundry. So
yeah. And I see you've upgraded from the laundry, but
well, you know, it could just be background. No, it was a big laundry. But there was undeniably a washing machine beside my desk.
This is not just real estate, Samantha. I mean, think about mortgage brokers. If you're going to get a mortgage, the mortgage broker is going to come to you. I mean, I've got a travel agent. I still use a travel agent through Flight Centre for, you know, bigger overseas trips. My travel agent comes to my house. She brings her laptop, she connects into whatever their system is, and she books flights on my kitchen table. My accountant comes to me. My lawyer comes to me. I mean, so many people are mobile. I mean, you wouldn't even think about it. And I find it extraordinary service when my accountant comes to me, when my lawyer comes to me, when my mortgage broker comes to me, when my travel agent comes to me. Extraordinary service. I actually love it. And we can all work from wherever now. So there's been a lot of pressure on offices for a while, and COVID has accelerated that massively in more businesses than just real estate.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I agree with you. Okay, have you saved the best to last?
Well, look, they're all pretty valid, but I will give you the last strategy. And that is that one of the advantages to working for myself, which really only came in hindsight, I didn't expect this, was that I built my own brand. And Josh Tesselin talked about, you know, saturating your market, and you've got to be everywhere. So, you know, when you do connect with people or meet people, they know who you are. They want to, you know, deal with you. I didn't know that this was going to happen when I did it. But over those years, every signboard that went up, every sold sticker that went on one of those signboards, every listing that went online was advertising my personal brand. What happened was that as I started to build that 20% market share, like we spoke about, it was my brand that people saw, not someone else's brand, not an agency's brand. And so I think that, you know, when you're first starting out in real estate, for some people, an agency brand's incredibly helpful. And it was to me as well. But for me, I'd been in the industry for 7 years at that point in time. You know, people already knew who I was, but working for myself, I was able to build my own brand, and it was my personal brand. And I think, Samantha, in real estate, our name is our brand. And so over those years, that's exactly what I built. Every sign, every listing, every sold board, every DL was just building. I didn't know it at the time, but I can see it looking back, was building my personal brand. And so that was really the number one accelerator that boosted me from 7 before the GFC, around 250 during the GFC, to 1.2 million consistently after the GFC, was that people in my area, bearing in mind I said I had a niche, houses in Paddington, $1 million plus, but anyone who owned a house in Paddington over $1 million knew who Dan Argent was. They knew who I was because I'd built my brand during that tough time. It only exacerbated as the market started to accelerate, as I started to get more and more and more listings and more transactions and more listings online. And, you know, I was selling about $50 million a year. So, you know, it was about 48 to 50 transactions a year for me. That was a lot of signboards, a lot of listings that people saw with my personal brand on it. Is it saving the best till last? You know, potentially, but it was certainly one of the most powerful strategies for me that kind of just came as a side product. I started my own business because I financially really needed to. I just couldn't keep losing $300,000 a year, you know, to an agency. But when I built my own brand off the back of that, it was the number one thing that really accelerated me.
You know, well, you've mentioned Josh a couple of times, as have I, because it was just a recent episode that we had. But I think, you know, when people get a bit scared, the marketing budget is the first budget to get cut. And I think where Josh has done really well is he's not cut it. He's actually increased it, you know, in order to saturate the market when everyone's kind of a bit shaky or a bit wobbly or a bit scared. It's actually, with my marketer's hat on, I think a pretty good strategy.
No, you're exactly right. And I always say a downturn isn't the time for downtime. You know, it's actually time to accelerate. A lot of people have kind of used this period to get their garden looking nice and maybe, you know, spending at Bunnings has gone up, you know, renovate their house. No, a downturn is not time for a downtime. It's time to actually really put the energy and really focus on your business. We spoke earlier about market share, you know, that you've only got to go from 5 listings to 7 and you might have a 20% market share. So you're right. Josh is right. If you are spending $5,000 a month on self-promotion, boost that to $10,000 a month. Actually find the funds to increase, because just like proving value to your vendor on why they should spend money on getting their house looking nice, if you actually invest in your personal brand, you know, this is a simple awareness campaign. Think about it like a funnel. I'm sure you will know this, but many of your listeners will have heard of a sales funnel, and people wonder what a sales funnel is. Well, imagine the shape of a funnel. The top of that funnel is how many people know you. People need to know you, like you, and trust you. So think of the top of the funnel as how many people know you. Halfway down the funnel, a certain portion of those will like you. Not everyone's going to like you, and that's just, you know, the reality of life. So let's just say 100 people know you, 50 people like you. And then further down the funnel is the skinniest part. Well, that's how many people trust you. And when I say trust you, it's they trust you that you're the person that can get them the best possible result. And that might be half again. So 100 people know you, 50 like you, 25 trust you. Well, people need to know you, like you, and trust you to do business with you. So how do you increase the bottom of the funnel? Well, you increase the top of the funnel. Instead of 100 people knowing you, how do you get 1,000 people to know you? Because if you can 10x the top of the funnel, you'll 10x the bottom of the funnel as well. And so this comes down to building a brand and saturation marketing. And this is an awareness campaign. And I think, Samantha, you know, agents have the opportunity. It's a simple opportunity. It's called an awareness campaign. If every single person who owns a property in their area knows who you are and what you do, then a certain portion of those will like you and trust that you're the person that can get the best possible result and they'll do business with you. So if you can't say hand on heart that every single person who owns a property in your area knows who you are and what you do, then there's your number one opportunity, is to really build that personal brand with your market and the people that you want to deal with.
Let's recap, shall we? Let's see how good my memory is. I'm scared on one of them right now, actually, but 21-20, so 20 calls, one appointment every day. And it sounds to me like you're a mornings in, afternoons out kind of guy.
Yep.
Okay, have clear goals. So make sure that, you know, you set yourself little rewards as well as big rewards when the goals get achieved.
That's it, small, medium, large. Like, think of a dog, you know. You pat a dog on the head, you say good job, and the dog will do that more often. So you want to pat yourself on the head, you know. You want to reward yourself with a coffee, reward yourself with a nice dinner out, reward yourself with a new watch or a handbag. Whatever little rewards all the time, and it'll drive those behaviours.
Presentation. Make sure that the price and presentation is absolutely in alignment. Reduce your costs, and if that means working for yourself and going back to the lounge room or the laundry, that's so be it. And lastly, focus on personal branding. So when everyone's decreasing expenditure, now's the time to sort of ratchet it up a bit.
100%. And understand that you are the brand in real estate and in many other professional services businesses, you know, outside of real estate. You know, whether you work at an agency or whether you work for yourself, it doesn't matter. People work with people. The brand that you want to build is your personal brand. You are the brand. And the more you invest in building your own personal brand and that self-promotion and build that awareness, it's not about ego either. It's just about awareness. I mean, it makes sense. You need to ensure that everyone who's in your market knows who you are and what you do. That's how business is going to come to you.
So let's get in the DeLorean and travel from the GFC or the end of the GFC into 2020 or 2021. And I'm a new agent entering real estate for the first time. What advice would you give me?
Well, if you're a brand new agent entering the industry listening to this, it would be the advice I give people every single week that ring me with this exact question. And that is, real estate is one of the most competitive industries in the world. And most people have no concept whatsoever as to how hard it is and what we actually do on a daily basis. Someone said to me recently, and I thought they articulated it really well, real estate's not a property game. If you want to get in the property game, become a developer. Real estate's about the people. And, you know, that's really the business that we're in, is people and relationships and service. And so that takes time to learn. And so the number one advice I'd give to anyone new getting in the industry is do an apprenticeship. Work for the best agent you can find. Find the best, highest performing agent that you can find that will give you a job. My last associate, my final year of sales, applied for about 40 positions before I gave him a job. And he was one of the best associates I ever had. So all those others that knocked him back certainly missed out. But, you know, he was desperate to find someone that he could work under and he could just learn from. And he became my shadow for 12 months. And Samantha, after that 12 months, he then went out on his own. At first year, did 315,000 GCI, and he just continues to grow from there. I did the same, and many of the best agents that I know have done an apprenticeship, a year, 2 years, whatever it takes, to learn the skills that you can only learn with on-the-job training. There's no book, there's no course. You've just got to be in the lounge rooms with the person who's got the experience and learn. And I think that would be my number one tip to anyone who's just starting out.
Dan, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your experiences with us today. It's been really, really amazing to sort of develop a little bit of a blueprint for, look, even if things don't get that bad, it's still not bad practice to think about your marketing and think about your costs and make those calls, do those reps. So I'm sure that everyone's gotten a lot out of that, but if there was one thing that you could leave people with, what would it be?
You're exactly right. These strategies work in a downtime. They work in a boom time. If you connect with 20 people a day and book one meeting a day during a boom time, I mean, you're just going to do even better. These strategies are people that, I mean, I love this industry, Samantha. I've been in it for 16 years. It's completely changed my life. I came from nothing. I came from absolutely nothing when I got into real estate. Many people that do well in real estate have a very similar story to me, and this industry has completely changed my life. So I hope that some of the people listening to this are able to implement some or all of these strategies and really not only survive a potential downturn, but also thrive and create a great life. You know, if I'm going to leave you with one tip, and that is, never get so busy making a living that you forget to make a life. This is a very demanding job. It's a very demanding industry. Many of us work 6-7 days a week and enormous hours, and it's very easy to lose sight of what matters. We've spoken a lot about, you know, vendors and pricing and marketing and working for yourself and money and goals and all those kind of things. But ultimately, the things that truly matter in life often don't scream the loudest. That's our health. You know, without our health, we have nothing. It's certainly wealth. And I would advise people, don't just earn a lot of money, but actually create wealth. Because the goal, in my opinion, for myself and certainly many that I speak to, is to build financial freedom. And we have the opportunity to do that in this industry. So, you know, if you earn $500,000 a year, don't blow $500,000 a year. Tom Panos talks about that. Number three, family. Ultimately, what's the point of achieving all of this is if you go and achieve it all alone? You know, I mean, who's it for? So super important. And last and finally, you can achieve amazing things. You can have great health and you can have a great family, but I find that the greatest fulfillment comes from contributing to others, particularly those less fortunate than ourselves. And certainly if I think about the proudest moments in my life, it's been those moments where I've been able to make an impact on someone. So whatever you're interested in, get involved in that. You know, you will gain so much personal enjoyment from, you know, getting involved in contributing to others. That would be my final point. Never get so busy making a living that you forget to make a life.
Yeah, I think that's a great one because, you know, in real estate, that's the primary goal, isn't it? Being able to contribute to others in a positive way.
Absolutely. Your clients, your family, yourself. Don't lose sight of yourself. So many agents I talk to lose sight of themselves. Their health goes out the window. Families go out the window. You know, and I was the same. I'm speaking from experience. You know, this comes from my own experience. That's one of the downsides to, you know, being a high performer, is it can have an enormous personal impact on your life. It certainly did on me, and I've learned a lot of lessons from that. I'm talking to you from the other side of that. You know, this is a funny observation, but I remember going to ARIC most years, and it was just this weird thing that I did, but I'd always look at the speakers and very few of them had a wedding ring on. And, you know, maybe some of them were married, didn't wear a ring or, but ultimately I know that this is a very demanding gig and it has a huge impact on a lot of people's families. And I've had a lot of people share with me the impact it's had on them personally or their families. And so yes, contribute to others, but make sure you contribute to yourself first and look after to yourself. The more you fill up your own cup, the more you'll have to give to others.
Yeah, well, that's right. And you do need someone to buy the handbag for, right?
That's exactly right. Well, I'd look pretty weird walking around with a handbag.
Dan Argent, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Elevate from Elite Agent. To download your written action guide from this podcast containing extra tips, links and shortcuts, visit eliteagentelevate.com.